War doesn't end when you leave the battlefield. The hardest fight comes after service. Identity, purpose, and tribe. Where do you stand when the uniform comes off? This is where we talk about it. No bullshit, no filters, just real stories from those who've been through it. This is the Great Guns Podcast with your host, James Scott.
The episode of Great Guns, and today I have an incredible guest, someone that has done a massive amount of service for their country, but has subsequently left the services and gone on to do great things. But I'm not going to talk too much about that because I think it's better to you hear it directly from him. So over to you, Emil, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, James, and nice to meet you. So yeah, I'm Emil Giesen. I'm a former Royal Marine Commando. I served 12 years through all three commando units, starting at 4-5, then down to 4-2 commando, then 4-2 commando, and I've done training team at Limston as well. Three tours of Afghanistan and invasion of Iraq also. And then I left the Corps in 2012. So I joined up in 2012 at the rank of sergeant.
Okay, and then from there, you didn't shy away from kind of conflict, if you like, because you literally went from kind of the battlefield to then going back to telling the stories of it through the camera lens. Kind of what made you pick up the camera and dive headfirst into that?
Yeah, so when I first left, I moved into the security industry like lots of veterans do. It's a natural progression for a lot of guys if they don't know what they're planning on doing, is to go into the CP world. And at the time when I was leaving, it was the maritime world with the Somali pirates. So for about a year and a half, I was working in the security industry. And then very quickly realized that, as people say, there's no security in security. One minute you've got a job, next minute you haven't got a job, you're chasing around looking for contracts, feast to famine, as they say it. One minute you're a pop star on the wages, the next minute you've got nothing in your pocket because there's no work and the competition. So I just, as I was doing the security work, I just realized that this isn't for me. I don't really enjoy working for other people as such. Obviously, coming out of the military, service, you do your job because you're part of a big organization. In the security industry, it's not like that at all. It's dog eat dog. So I didn't really enjoy it. And then one night I was out down in Devon having a few drinks, and one of my friends pulled me aside and said, "Oh, listen to this guy's story." I was like, "Okay." And I was speaking to a guy, his ex-sailor. He was going out to fight ISIS. He was joining a group of Westerners that were joining the Kurds to fight against Islamic State. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. My background is my father's from Syria. He's a Christian Arab. My family's still in Syria. And I just left the Corps and I thought, okay, I've got the skills to go fight in the Middle East against ISIS. I've got family there, but I don't feel that's my calling. I don't feel that that's something I want to do. But I met this guy in a bar who's like, he wants to go do it. So I was like, okay, this is strange. He's got no connection to the Middle East and he didn't really understand the politics on who's who out there. So the next day I met him for a coffee. I spoke to him and I was like, what's your plan? He goes, oh, it's a group of British guys and Australians and Americans that are going out to fight ISIS. I didn't have any knowledge of TV or anything. So I sent emails out to production companies, going, I've got this brilliant idea. This is who I am. This is the guy I've met, all his contacts. He wants me to come out and film with him. They were like, yeah, that's great, we love it. And then 2 days before we were supposed to fly, they cancelled, they pulled out because insurance, the danger, they couldn't confirm the access was 100%. So the guy who was the cameraman goes, why don't you just buy a camera and go yourself? And I was like, I don't have a clue about anything about cameras. He sent me some links. I then went on eBay, bought a camera, drove up to Manchester, bought a camera of some guy outside his house for about $700, and then drove down to Heathrow and then got on a plane and started following these bunch of guys around the Middle East, making my first documentary, which is a feature film. So that's really how I got into filming to start with.
So, I mean, that's quite something. I mean, going with no experience, no backup, how do you feel going from a combatant to becoming kind of the observer? I mean, did you struggle with that whole switch?
Yeah, a lot of people ask that question. I was quite content not to be carrying a weapon, to be just stare as a fly on the wall. Is when you're in the military and someone's shooting at you, you've got to fire back. You've got to be part of the battle. When you've got a camera, it's very different. It's a different feeling. Is that you have to watch the people around you and how they fight. You are literally a fly on the wall. You're just there to observe. So it was a bit of eye-opening to start with on the difference. But I didn't really ever, throughout my time filming, have ever felt like I needed to pick up a rifle. I'm happy to be on a fly. Of course, during leaving the Corps as a troop sergeant, I'm seeing some of these guys' skills in the Middle East, and I'm like, you shouldn't be doing that. But it's not my job to tell them this. Or looking at how they're digging positions and going, well, this is not a good... It's not my place really to tell them or advise them, because I'm a cameraman. I'm filming things. But yeah, for about a year and a half, I was back and forth in the Middle East, Iraq and Syria. And then afterwards, I then thought, okay, I enjoy this. I'm making this film and it's really hard to do it. I'm learning on the job how to make this. Because once you've got the product, you then got to go, okay, right, I filmed all this stuff. What do I do with the footage? How do I edit? I don't know how to edit. I then had to find someone who could edit to put it together to make it a feature film. And luckily, we managed to get it, and we've done private screenings of the first documentary, which were quite successful. And then I was like, I want to do another one. And then I realised, BFBS, they were opening a scholarship for film academy up in Clouthorne St. Peter's, I think it is. So what it was, is I went for an interview with them. I won a position on the course. It was a year-long course where what they do is they're taking what we had, 15 veterans that were on there. They gave us a scholarship, so they've given us £2,000 a month to live, as well as the free education on media studies and stuff. So I then completed the course with them, which was great, and it set me up to have a better understanding in editing, storytelling, and social media and everything, which then I went out to Ukraine to then make my second documentary. I was actually, we had 2 weeks work experience to go out and make a documentary. And I was like, right, I've got all this equipment here at my disposal. I'm going to Ukraine. This is 2017. I was like, I'm going to go out there. And the head teacher was like, you're not going to Ukraine, are you, for your documentary? I was like, no. Before I know it, I was on the front line with all her equipment, getting messages from her going, I know you're out on the front line with all our equipment, bring it back safe. So yeah, from there, I was going back and forth to Ukraine, making that second documentary, which we then done a screening off as well in several locations. So then I had two documentaries.
Sorry, it was just to chirp in there. Was that the 45 days?
No.
That wasn't that one?
No, the first documentary on ISIS was Robin Hood Complex, against Islamic State, and then Europe's Forgotten War, Robin Hood Complex as well, because it was volunteers that were fighting in Ukraine. And then... now we're coming in really to COVID times where everything just shut down. And then I sat home and then I realized there was a war going on in Armenia and between Armenia and Azerbaijan over in Nagorno-Karabakh territories called Artsakh by Armenians. It's where Armenian people have been living for many years. And I thought, okay, what are the travel restrictions at the moment? Can I get there? Because I have a press card, I was allowed to travel. So I then went travel to Armenia, and I then covered the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan for the documentary 45 Days, The Fight for a Nation, which was my most successful documentary. It's another feature film, which we premiered in Hollywood, done a massive tour of America. We've done it in the Chinese theater. In fact, we Chinese theater on Hollywood, in Hollywood twice, sold out every event. We've done New York, Canada, we've done London, Australia as well. So it was quite successful. We even had it entered into the Oscars. We were trying to go in for the best feature in the Oscars. Unfortunately, we didn't make it to the shortlist because it's a lot of work and a lot of expense, actually. There's a lot of money behind putting stuff into the Oscars. But we had a great time. And it was the best thing about 45 Days of Fight for a Nation. It's a human, almost my documentary is a humanized stories about, it's not about the war as such. It's about the people involved in the war. And you can pick that up in every country you go to, that people are people, their concerns, their rights, what they feel, how they want things to happen are all the same, no matter what color skin they have, religious backgrounds. So, yeah, it was 45 Days was a really iconic film. And it's quite emotional in places because you see the raw truth of people being ethnically cleansed by the Azeris and the Turks, forced off their lands, burning their homes down. So, yeah, it was a really great project to work on.
And how going into situations like that where you see kind of it raw and you're seeing it from the people's perspective, how has that kind of shaped your outtake on life you know, nowadays? Because obviously once you were kind of being sent to these spots to go and do a job, and now you're just viewing it as a spectator. How's that changed your perspective on life?
Yeah, when you're in the armed forces, you're doing a job. This is your mission. This is what you need to achieve, and you just want to come home alive. Simple as. When you're doing camera work, is, for example, if you're patrolling around Afghanistan, the chances are people aren't going to be inviting into your house to tell you their story, because they see you as, okay, you're coming in here, the Taliban might come, or you might kill me. But when you've got a camera, it opens doors. The amount of places I've been that I would never have gone, the amount of people I've met who I'd never have met if I didn't have a camera, because people want to tell their story. So for me as a filmmaker, it's eye-opening that people welcome you into their lives for a short period of time to tell their story, because they feel like their voices aren't heard. So for me, transition from the military into the filmmaking world, you've got to have a bit more compassion, in the sense that you're dealing with people's stories. You're not just a soldier walking around with a weapons doing your jobs. You're now people entrusting you with their story and just being with you. So yeah, it's really eye-opening just to transition to be a little bit softer in my approach, rather than being semi-aggressive and then hearts and minds in the military kind of thing, is that you've got to have that balance where you're just constantly consistent. But the issue you've got is obviously security. All these places, majority of the time I'm on my own. I'm latching on to soldiers or militia groups for them to provide me my security. And yeah, very much all my projects, I've been taking my life into my own hands. In fact, as I don't have insurance, I'm a self-employed filmmaker. You've got to run the gauntlet once in a while, but it's paid off just to tell these people's stories. And especially with 45 Days, the documentary there is, because COVID was happening, the world was silent about what was going on. Also, Azerbaijan and Turkey spent millions in propaganda to silence and change the narrative of what that was going on in that conflict. And because the world was busy with COVID, no one was really interested. A lot of people didn't even know there was a war between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Yeah. So really, the footage we captured on that project, which was over a year and a half project in total, is a testament to history. That footage we've got, no one else has got. In some places, the Russian peacekeepers going in, for example, people burning down their homes because they've told, right, you've got 2 days to leave before you're going to be arrested. And that. So it is it's documenting history. And to me, that's the most passionate thing I'm about, is showing a time in place that people can't dispute and go, that's not true, that never happened. It's like, well, here's footage of it actually did happen. This is part of the history of the world. But yeah, the clever timing of that war was iconic for the Azeris. They picked their moment when they knew there was an election in USA and problems with COVID.
Jeez, yeah. So I wanted to ask you, picking up the camera, how did that stepping into filmmaking such, how did that kind of get you to regain your sense of purpose, after leaving the forces?
Yeah, I think the hardest part for guys and girls who leave the military is, one minute you're in uniform and you're surrounded by all your friends. The next day you're walking out the gate as a civilian where you're giving in your ID card. You can't actually go back into the base without someone escorting you officially. So it is a massive jump. And I think for a lot of service people, I say it's about the 2 year mark, 2 to 3 year mark before you fully transition from military to civilian. And that's generally the hardest part. I think a lot of guys leave the military without a plan. I didn't really have a plan. I thought, oh, I'm going to go into security. It's going to be great. I'm earning loads of money. That soon worked out that that's not the case. So once you're out on your own, if you're in the military, you have a problem, you can go speak to your troop sergeant or your mates or your troop boss, sergeant major. You've got a network. You've got somewhere to live. You've also got somewhere you can go eat. Everything's there for you. You're told what time to be somewhere, what to wear, everything. Yeah. It's that routine. But when you're in the civilian world, there is no routine. You're on your own. And I think a lot of people who are very much institutionalized because they've joined the military at a young age, they've never really had a job before, they go into this structure and then they leave it. It's like a sausage factory. You're just thrown out at the end and you're like, what's next? So yeah, the transition I found hard for about 2 years. And I think the hardest part for a lot of people is just the financial aspect of it. Of where in the Corps or the military, you know, at the end of the month, you're getting paid. Not everyone in the civilian street has that luxury. So it is very tough for a lot of people.
So what would your single piece of advice be for anybody that's hasn't left yet but is looking to exit? What would that be?
I would definitely say don't do it premature. Make sure you know what you want to do when you leave. Don't just try and wing it thinking, oh, things will be okay. Definitely use your resettlement time to do courses and find a career. This is what a lot of people don't realize. They do X amount of years in the military. Even if you joined up at 18, you've done 22 years, you can be retiring at the age of 40. That's still time to do another career. There's nothing wrong with finding a second career and go, okay, I had a great military life. Now I want to find something I'm passionate about. And I think that's what it is people need to find a job they're passionate about and then try to do training courses or do as much research as they can and be financially stable before they leave. I think that's the issue. A lot of people in the armed forces, they live hand to mouth. They get paid in a month. They spend all the money all that month. They're back to zero. Then the paycheck comes in. Definitely, I would say, is like have some money saved up. You need that contingency. If you're not getting work, you get laid off, you need to pay your mortgage or your rent. So you need to put fuel in the car. So definitely, I would suggest anyone who's leaving the military is make sure you have a bit of financial support behind you and you've done training on the sector that you know you want to go into.
Yeah, which makes sense. It's having that plan. When you had obviously left, did you find that you needed to lean on anybody or get support from anyone? Or did you feel that there was support there for you if you needed it?
I think the issue is when I left, slowly over a period of time, you saw that your good friends from the military soon drop off. They become more distant in the fact is that they're not replying to your message all the time because you're on a different routine. They're obviously working, they've got their routine, you've got your routine, they're away in the field or they're overseas. So over months, I saw it gradually, good friends of mine just from the military slowly dip off. And then a year later, they pop up in a message and they go, how are you? What are you up to? You have a little catch up. But yeah, I think friendships, of course, from the military, I've still got some great mates I keep in touch with, but not as many as I had when I was in the military because life changes. People grow up. People start families, they get girlfriends, wives. So yeah, there is that transition period. It's quite hard because one minute you're with all your friends working and the next minute you're sat at home or you're going to your work and you're like, what are they up to? Do you want to have a beer? Oh, I can't have a beer tonight kind of thing. So yeah, there was many times, especially after I left the security and I started the first documentary where I literally had no money. I had to borrow money and it was like, where can I borrow money from? I don't want to go to the banks. I've already got credit cards and debt. Turn into good bootneck mates and go, mate, can you lend me a grand? I feel bad asking for it, but I need to pay my rent this month. So there was very tough times while I was trying to make the documentary because it's all freelance. I'm not getting paid. I'd have to come back to the UK, find some work. I was doing a lot of surveillance work in between making my films. That was keeping the money going, really. But yeah, it was a very ups and downs throughout that whole period of time. Luckily now I'm very lucky to say I'm quite successful in what I've achieved and everything, but it was a roller coaster. Definitely like lots of downs, a few ups, but it worked out. I remember my dad's even I had to borrow £500 of my dad to buy some wireless and microphones because my first trip to the Middle East, I was like, the sound quality is not good. I need these. So then I'm speaking to people and go, what do you use? And they go, you need wireless mics. I was like, oh, how much are they? £500. I was like, well, I need that £500. I need to have a flight back when I go back. So I was going to my dad. I was like, Dad, can you lend me this money? I'll give you it back. And he's like, what are you doing? Give it all up. You mean just go get a normal job? And obviously, as a father, he doesn't want to see his son struggling. And I was like, nope, I've started. I'm going to finish it. And now he's like, oh, well done, son. Well done. So, do you know what I mean? It's worked out, but there was many times I thought, and I think a lot of people when they leave the military think, oh, life's hard. I'm going to quit. But sometimes you just need to just keep moving forward and not quit. And I'm glad I didn't quit when I'm making the films.
Yeah. No. That's good. And in those tough times, and I think you alluded there. You said like dark times. What was your process of kind of making sure that you keep moving forward? What was that? Was it Did you have someone that was kind of pushing you along, or was it just your own resilience that was pushing you along? What was it for you?
Generally, whiskey. That was like my motivation. Having some whiskeys and feeling like, right, you need to just keep going because it's going to get worse if you just stop. I think what it is, once you've got a plan, and my plan was, right, make my first feature of documentary. I'm going to do it whatever way I can. I'm going to beg, borrow, and steal, work wherever I can, do whatever jobs that's out there, even if it's a cleaning job or taxi driver, whatever it is, get some money to then go, right, my next part of this project is now going to an editor. I need to get the money to go to an editor to get this on board. So it's just step by step. But yeah, no, I had a lot of dark times and a lot of doubting. But like I said, just have a whiskey and crack on. It's like, right, this is what we need to achieve. How do we do it? My mindset very much is, if there's a problem, it's like, what's the solution? How do we find that solution? I'm not very much one of them guys who sit and wallow and think, okay, times are really bad. Oh my God, kind of thing. It's like, okay, what do we do? How do we get out of this situation? So I'm very good at processing. I go, right, this is the problem. Here's the solution. How do I get from problem to solution to overcome it, to move on to the next problem? So very much, yeah, it's just processing. But even friends, I had lots of friends that were telling me I'm stupid. Like, why do you keep going out? The dangerous, you're going to end up in an orange jumpsuit. You don't know what you're doing. Go get a real job. So, and they're good friends. They were like, they're not being cruel. They'll just say it. They just see the reality and go for it. Just not go for it. As in give it up. But now I've come out the other side. People are like, okay, yeah, that was great. I've been following your journey on all these projects that you've done. I think a lot of guys just need to realize that tough times don't last forever. Is we all been there. Even if people that you think are very resilient and strong, they've all been a dip in life. There's nothing worse than having not a penny to your name, that you can't put money in your car. You're having to borrow from friends. It's the most embarrassing thing ever. But like one of my friends, he likes reminding me that he had to lend me money for one of my trips. And I was like, yeah, I paid you back. He goes, yeah. And I gave you interest as well. But he likes to remind me all the time. He's like, oh, look at you. You're a bit all flashy now. And I'm like, do you remember that time I had to lend you £1,000? I'm like, yes, I remember that time. But that's what guys are like.
Yeah, so it sounds like you were lucky that you had a good base of good mates that were...
Yeah.
They're looking out for you. And when they're looking out for you, it's not always a case of it's what you want to hear. Sometimes they can be restricted in their own beliefs. So no, don't do it. It's dangerous. You shouldn't be doing it. Whereas when you get out the other end, they're probably going, oh shit, I wish I'd done that. Maybe yeah, I could totally. Do something like that. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's because going into the filmmaking world it was very unique that not many people from the military have moved into that sector. Of course, there's a few people have been very successful, but it's quite niche as such. And it's very uncertain. Now, that's why I think a lot of my friends were like, ooh, it's a bit of a risk. What are you going to do if it doesn't come off? What are you going to do if no one comes and watches your film, no one buys tickets and stuff, or no TV company picks it up? So it is uncharted waters. And now I get a lot of guys who are leaving the military, like messaging me and going, I want to get into what you're doing. How do I go about it and stuff? So, yeah, there's more of an appetite for guys going off into little quirky little genres and kind of new jobs rather than the status quo of going to the security world or go into a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah. Do you think that was part of the problem, but do you think that's where a lot of them struggled, was because they thought you kind of leave that and then you've got to go into a specific line of work, and instead of kind of opening it broadly and going, what is it I actually want to do? Because I know quite a few veterans and they've each got their own story. But I'm surprised how many went into either police or fire or ambulance service straight away and then realized after a few years, well, it's not quite what I wanted. And then they end up doing something else. So do you think that's changing or not?
Oh, I don't think so. I think the appetite for people to go into another organization that's very similar to the military is a natural progression because they see it as routine job. Especially, we all get caught on this issue about pensions, how great pensions are and stuff like this. And then you only realize when you actually leave the military, if you don't do the full 22 years, that the pension's pretty crap, really. And now they keep changing the goalposts. But a lot of guys always were instilled into us in Britain about pensions. Look, build your pension up because when you're going to be old. So I think a lot of men and women, when they leave, they look into what job can I still continue my pension? It's very much a notion that we feel that we need a desire to do. So I think, yeah, moving into a uniform organization, a lot of people feel safe going into them environments. And I know I've got lots of friends who join the police and the fire service who hate it. They regret joining the police and the fire service because it's not really what they thought. Generally, more guys I know enjoy being in the fire service than in the police. It's just the system. But I think it's a natural progression because you're going from one uniform organization of discipline to another. So I think a lot of guys feel more comfortable doing that.
Yeah, okay. Makes sense. So I wanted to ask, what's next for you then? What's on the horizon?
So I've been in and out of Ukraine since the beginning of the latest invasion in 2022. So I've been flown around. I got into Ukraine on, 4 days after the invasion, because I'd literally just come back from California where we were doing, I was out in California with the last documentary, come back. And then whenever there's a war, everyone always goes to me, you go into it. And I'm like, no. And then I look at flights and then I'm like, okay, I might go. And that was very much with Ukraine. I was like, Putin's not going to invade Ukraine. He's not stupid enough for that. He was. And then I literally got back from LA and I was like, right, okay, how do I get into Ukraine? Because there's no flights going in now. Got worked it out. Okay. And then I was on a train going into Kiev in the middle of the night with just four other people. The other direction, as they're coming out, there's thousands of civilians and only four of us going up into Kiev that night. So about a year and a half, I was out in Ukraine. Took a couple of weeks off here and there. I was very much focused on the projects out there. But my vision was, if the Russians do come into Kiev, literally all the big media companies started pulling all their guys. They go, it's too dangerous now in Kiev. The Russians are surrounded it. And there was only a handful of us left. We actually found a basement bar, which was, we could get a hot meal and we could buy alcohol at extortionate prices. But it was like, it was a bit of safety because it was underground. And there was a military checkpoint outside. But we were like, okay, we're going to batten down. We're going to stay in the city. If the Russians come in, we'll be here. And I was going to make a documentary on the Russians coming into Kiev. That was my objective. Yeah. Thankfully, the Russians didn't come into Kiev, so I didn't make that film. But I've been existing, working on lots of other media stuff out in Ukraine since the beginning of the war.
What is it that, with all the work that you're doing and conflicts and that you've documented, what is it that you want people to take away from what you're capturing as such?
Yeah, it's a good question. I want people, when, like I said, my main projects, the big projects I would do lots of work, but my main documentaries is I want people to see the human side of the people that suffer in war. I've seen it on the front line myself as a military man, and now I see it behind the camera as in people's stories, the people's stories who, when you're in the military, you don't really see because you're busy doing your missions or your operations. Yeah. But through the film work is I want people to understand the suffering that people during wartime, but I also want to see the good times, the resilience of human nature in their time of darkness, where their house has just been destroyed, two of their children are dead, but they can still see some form of positive in how to move forward. That sounds a bit random, but there is always a lot of light in dark places, especially in war, and that's through storytelling. Rather than just showing a news article, we can all watch Sky News or BBC, whatever news channel it is, you get a snippet. Wherefore, with filmmaking and documentaries, you get the luxury of giving more time to an individual and developing their story so people can understand. And then that's the key thing for all movies and documentaries is you want your audience to relate to that person. And so when we've got characters, I call them characters as such, and they're obviously real people. But you want someone, an audience, to look and go, that could be my mum, or that could be my father, that could be my sister, and they can relate to it. And it breaks down the boundaries of, I don't care what religion they are, I don't care their skin colour or anything else. I relate to that because really, that person's only there by birthright because they were born here. I'm born somewhere totally different, but really, that could be me, or that could be our family. And I think that's the powerful thing about telling stories is, people need to be able to relate to their audience, to what they're watching, and go, actually, yeah, it's just that person living in Syria or that person living in Ukraine. That could be us if there was a war in our country. There was, like, during World War II as such. So people in Britain can relate to it to a certain degree because it is all about storytelling. And I'm just passionate about telling stories.
What's the most human moment you've actually captured on film, maybe not captured on film, that you maybe not have used, but like the most human moment that you've witnessed in all the time that you've been doing this?
I would say it's actually from 45 Days, the documentaries, when we're in Artsakh and Nagorno-Karabakh, and there was just lines and lines of cars of people having to get out. And we were just stuck. And in the, you see in the documentary, actually, we used a lot of the footage because it was just, it's just perfect. I've got a drone up. You can see the thousands of cars with the packed with the sofa on top of the roof. They but whatever they can get out of their house. And then as we're in this line of traffic, and the deadline's like 4 hours before they need to leave this territory because they're being expelled from their land, is you start seeing fires everywhere. So we get out of the cars, we're stuck in traffic, and I'm like, what's going on? And one of the guys who could talk Armenian was like, people are burning their houses down. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, they're burning all their houses down because they don't want their Azeris to have their house. And I was like, and that's when the penny dropped to me. I was like, and it was quite emotional scenes that people prepare, because they've been thrown off their land, they're prepared to burn their house down so their enemy can't use their house. And it's just to get to that stage where they've grown up in that house. Their grandparents used to live in that house. Their grandparents before them were in that house. And then all of a sudden they're like, we're going to take out whatever we can and then we're going to burn it because we don't want anyone else to have it. And just standing there with civilians as they're watching their family homes burn down is like touching and it's emotional. And then at the same time, we crossed over the road because everyone's out their cars because traffic's not moving because there's like so many people trying to flee. And there's a guy and he's got some like pita bread and some vodka, homemade vodka. And he's there on the side of the road giving out bread, doing toasts of vodka while all these houses around us are just burning. And they're telling stories, laughing, joking. And it's surreal moments like that as a filmmaker that there's no reason for me to be there. But because I've got a camera, I'm in this situation. And they're happy to show the hardest part of life. I've just burnt down my house. Now I'm having a shot of vodka and a bit of bread, toasting everyone and telling jokes because this is the situation we're in. So there's I've had a lot of surreal moments, especially when I'm with militias. Like I was in the mountains of Iran, crossed over from Iraq. I was with the militia up there, the Kurdish militia. And it's just like going on patrol with them and they're looking for Iranian special forces. I'm like, how? And I'm dressed as one of these guys now. I'm like, how am I going to explain if I get caught by the Iranians that I'm with the militia dressed as them, being a British guy? Classic, I'm a spy in their eyes. I'd be tortured. And then I'm going out on the patrol and then we're going back to cave complexes and we're eating watermelon and playing chess in the dark with a little candle. And then you can hear Turkish fighter jets overhead as well. And it's just like, what is this world all about? So yeah, there's been a lot of interesting moments on all my journeys.
Yeah, I'd say. How do you prevent yourself from kind of allowing it to kind of overtake you kind of from an emotional point of view and dealing with the things that you see? What do you do to combat that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm like an overly emotional person in general, but of course I get touched by people around me. And of course, I'm not saying I'm heartless. I don't have any emotion whatsoever, but I'm able to control my emotions a little bit more. But the beauty of having a camera is a barrier. So you imagine I'm filming you now, you're getting really emotional. Is what I would do is I would then focus on the camera rather than focusing on you, because then that gives me a natural barrier not to get too emotionally over like invested into what you're doing. I've got a job, I need to film this situation. So yeah, especially the camera, you can use it as a barrier when you need to. Of course, you don't want to have it as a barrier between two people, but when it gets a bit emotional, there is times you need to do it. And in fact, even in 45 days, there's a scene where we go and we meet a wife whose husband had died. And this woman, she was so like in love with him. It was unreal how much she loved him, the way she spoke about him. And she weren't speaking English. She's speaking in Armenian. And I don't understand Armenian. And I'm sat there and I've got one of my friends. She's an American Armenian who's translating for me. And she didn't need to translate, because the moment of this woman showing pictures of her husband, and this is what I'm saying, it's, you don't need to be able to speak the language to understand emotion.
Yeah.
And then I had a cameraman with me for that one, actually, and he caught me crying because I'm sat there and I'm listening to this woman in a different language talk about her love for her husband. You see her children stood in the doorway because they've just lost their father. It's like these moments, and she's then trying to give us cake. She's trying to feed us. And it's like, you're at the worst, lowest moment of your life, but you're still trying to accommodate your guests. And it's really surreal that this woman was trying to do it. So it sometimes it's hard not to get too invested in what's going on. But there's other times like, right, I'm here to do a job. I need to get this story because it's an important story to tell. But yeah, humans were sponges. We pick up on emotions around us. If you hang around with 5 negative people, you're going to be a 6th negative person. If you hang around with X amount of sad people, you're going to be another sad person or happy person. So yeah, very much it can get too overbearing when you've got too much on you because you're seeing so many horrible things. But I tried to like compartmentalize things and go, okay, right, I had no action in that. There's nothing I could have done to change any of that. Yeah. I'm there just as an observer. So that way I try to go, right, let's put that aside and let's focus on what we need to do.
Yeah, you're amazingly privileged to be able to view that kind of human emotion in situations. I would assume you feel very privileged to be able to witness
that. And that's the thing, like I said, with a camera, it opens doors because people want to tell your story, especially being British, is whatever everyone says about the BBC is the BBC and it is what it is, but it's an institution. And this is what people need to realise all around the world. And I'm not singing or praising or endorsing the BBC, but because the BBC World Service is everyone around the world has a respect for Britishness as such, mainly because the institution of the BBC, because it's given people around the world news. Like my father from Syria was saying that he used to listen on the wireless to the BBC in Damascus because they see it as the British can be trusted. It's a weird kind of thing. So when I meet people and I say I'm British, a lot of them are quite open to go, oh, you're a British filmmaker. Come, I want to tell you my story. I'm not saying they dismiss other nationalities, but it seemed to be a lot easier. And I noticed that, especially in Ukraine recently, is because we were one of the first countries to give support to Ukraine. So whenever I was going through a military checkpoint and they saw your British passport, they're like, go, Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson. So it has worked in the favour of opening doors as such.
Right. Now, I remember reading, this is kind of going right back to the beginning. I remember reading that when you were in the Royal Marines, you were part of the recruitment instructors.
Yeah.
Just a little snippet here then. For anyone that's thinking of joining the Royal Marines, any youngster out there, what advice would you give them? I know we like to talk about veterans, but what about one of the new recruits?
My son's at 17 now. He's at that age where he could actually go if he chooses to go. I've never tried to force him or like endorsed him to go, but he's now in that age group where of young men going through the doors as such. I'd say definitely if you want a career in the military, whatever cap badge it is, go for it. Even if you just do the minimum service, it sets you up in life for when you leave. It's a great opportunity. One, like we mentioned earlier, you get paid every month. You get to travel and you get to work with your best friends. If anyone wanted to join the Royal Marines, as the slogan goes, it's a state of mind. It very much is a state of mind. Is your body can go through a lot. And when I was in training, I got injured. I also got back trooped. It's like you expect to turn up on day one, pass out after 30 odd weeks, get your green berry and move on. Sometimes it's all life. You stumble, you fail something. You have to go back, redo it. I would say anyone who is wanting to join the Royal Marines is you've got to stick with it. If you want to have that green beret, the only person stopping you is yourself. You don't even need to be the super fittest guy ever. As long as you can keep up, you can do what you need to do. But mentally, when you're down and you're wet, you're cold and hungry, you just keep going because you know what the end goal is. And the end goal is passing out. It's for any cat badge is knowing that's the end. I've just got to run the journey of in between. So when I was a recruit instructor, it was one of the best jobs I had is teaching young men on how to become soldiers. I found it very rewarding and I really loved my time at Limpston. It's because when I went through training, I didn't really like my training team. I thought they were all a bunch of douchebags who just wanted to punish us. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to be firm with the guys. And don't get me wrong, anyone who I passed out knows how firm I was and I would frag them. But at the same time, I was approachable. I would then give them experience. I'd be like, okay, the reason why I'm about to beast you is because what you've done, X, Y, and Z, if you've done that in Afghanistan, this is the consequences of what you've just done. You wake up in the morning, not eating your breakfast, and then going for an 8-mile load carry, you've got no food in you. So what's happening now in Afghanistan, if you go down on patrols, you haven't eaten, that means a Medi helicopter has to come out, risk the lives of all the men on that helicopter to Kazivac you because you couldn't be bothered to have breakfast in the morning. So this is why we're going to go for a little run. But at the same time, it'd be like, why are you struggling? Oh, I'm struggling because map reading. Okay, in the evening, I'll give you an hour of my personal time. I'm going to teach you one-on-one how to do map reading, like to a better standard, because I don't want you failing it and being backtrooped 2 weeks because you couldn't understand. Because not everyone learns the same. And I think a lot of recruit instructors struggle with this who aren't really people persons, because they realize you're not getting it. You're stupid. I don't have time for you. But when you're in these roles of education, whatever education is, you need to educate someone. And not everyone would learn at the same speed. So you need to pull people aside and go, okay, what are you struggling on? Like one recruit, I'm going on a tangent now, but I had one recruit who just couldn't understand how to do his kit muster. He just couldn't understand the logical sense of, right, I need my food cooking as I'm cleaning my weapons. Once I've done that, I then need to do this. Da-da. So I was like, why can't you do it? And he got backtrooped to me. And I was like, to his other corporal, I was like on the phone. I go, what's his problem? He's shit. Okay, but why is he shit? He goes, he's shit. He just doesn't listen. I'm like, okay. The guy has a processing issue. He doesn't understand. He can't process what needs to be done in what order. I was like, simple, crib cards. Let's get a little Fablon crib card. And you've got it written down there so you can go off a checklist. Will that help you? And he goes, yeah, perfect. Next time in the field, he's done everything. It's because he's using this system of going, okay, what do I need to do next? I need to make sure my water bottles are filled. Okay, right, going to do that. If you leave him to his own process, he's not going to understand. So he needs this list. And I think, yeah, that's the key to education and military training, is better instructors who understand why people are failing at certain things. But yeah, I love my time as a recruit instructor. I found it very rewarding.
In a very different arena, but very similar, I can relate to exactly what you've just been saying. I'm an adult volunteer with the Army Cadet Force. And it's exactly that. You know, some kids, people just go, yeah, they're stupid, they don't get it, whatever. But if you just spend the time, it's like one little thing, and then suddenly they're one of your best cadets, and they're thriving and getting on with it. So yeah, I can appreciate that.
It's like buying sort of a flat pack from IKEA. I'm the sort of guy who will get the instructions out and then just think, I can wing this. I don't need to look every bit of the instructions. Yep. I can just work it out. And then I get to a stage where I've made a mistake and then I need to go back and then I move forward. Some people that way, other people literally go through every step by step and lay everything out. We all have a different way of learning. And just because you're in the armed forces doesn't mean it's any different. Yeah. I was speaking to my troop commander at the time, and I said to him, we all have there's like a system on how you learn. I don't know. I can't remember the names and terminology of how people learn. But at the time I did. And I was like to him, why don't we match up, do the test for all the instructors on that our way of the way we learn, because that would be the way we teach. And let's do it with the recruits and then marry up the recruits that got similar traits to the instructor. Yeah. Because I thought, and I was trying, and he was like, oh, that won't work. Limston won't be interested. I was like, but just trying to think about, okay, maybe all these kids that are in front of me, the ones that are very similar to the way I learn, will obviously progress better with me and Vicky Verkey. But yeah, no, it's just trying to work out, okay, because I got really annoyed at Limston when people, because I was backtrooped, when guys would be backtrooped to me 2 weeks or 4 weeks, and I'm like, why are you here? And they're like, I don't know, because I failed this. I go, but why have you failed that? You shouldn't have failed that. If you had an instructor who taught you, you'd be able to get through that. So I made it my aim not to, of course, guys left, but I never backtrooped anyone because I thought if they were that bad, if they were good enough standard to be there, I can then get them across the line on what they needed. Of course, there was guys that was like, you just totally not getting the standard. You need to voluntary leave because you're not up there. And I had it with one recruit actually, who it was a young 17-year-old boy. He just rabbit in the headlights, didn't have a clue what he's doing. And I was just like to him, you're going home. You're not ready to be here. And that means like, oh, I go, you need to make the decision. If you get off the list, by the time you get back to camp from the field, if you want to be here or not, I go, but you need to make that decision. He came back, really, I pressured him into quitting because he just wasn't mentally ready or physically. And then he came in, he quit. And then, what was it? It was about 3 years later, three, 4 years later, I was on the train. And he come up to me, this kid. And I couldn't remember him at the stage. And he was like, oh, Corporal Geeson. I was like, oh, Sergeant Geeson, like, who are you? He goes, oh, I'm such and such, the guy, remember? And I was like, I go, what are you up to? He goes, I've just passed out of training. He goes, I took your advice. I went back to college. I then got a job. I grew up and then I came back and I passed first time. And I was like, brilliant. Like, I'm proud of you for doing that. Because some people aren't mentally ready at that particular times. And even looking back at me, like I said, I've got a 17-year-old son now. And I joined the Corps when I was 18. And looking at my son, who's 17, he's mature, but he's still not a man as such. And I think I joined the Corps at the age of 18. I was immature still. Is I would have got a lot more benefit from maybe delaying it a little bit later, maybe to 21, to get a bit more life experience before joining the Corps. But yeah, there are some great recruits that join at 16, 17, and 18. I'm not taking that away from anyone. But yeah, like we mentioned earlier, if you want it, you'll achieve it.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for that. Where can people find you and find out more about you if they want to follow what you're up to?
Yeah, I'm on all social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, X, Facebook. So, yeah. But I've been a bit quiet recently, actually, like on projects and stuff like that, because I'm taking a bit of a step back. Just work, like you said, what's next for me is I'm still working out is, do I want to continue go down the route of war documentaries? Or I'm getting a little bit older now and a bit slower and a bit fatter, is maybe look into different projects that are a little bit less dangerous. So I'm still in that stage at the moment of working out what's going to be my next main project. But yeah, people can find me on social media.
Brilliant. Okay. We'll include the links on the podcast launch under the notes.
Perfect.
So, but yeah, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed chatting to you and finally getting to meet you, even though I was sent your way a couple of years back now, and I just never got around to doing it. So, but I'm glad I have. All the best for whatever your next venture is, and I'll certainly be keeping an eye and ear out for what you're up to.
Yeah, appreciate it.
So thanks very much. I appreciate
it. Thanks for your time, James.
All right. Take cheers. Care. Thanks a lot.
Bye. That's a wrap, folks, and a big thank you to our guest. Remember, keep moving forward. The fight's not over until you decide it is. Till next time, stay bold, stay fearless. Live life like it's too short for half measures. This is the Great Guns Podcast, signing off. And remember to subscribe to join our tribe.